Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. I've long been interested in the work of the Independent Transport Commission, the UK's foremost independent transport and land use think tank. Some years ago, the seeds were planted for work on why people travel. The outcome of this, and after over 2 years' work, is a new book published by the Bristol University Press. Why Travel has contributions from many notable academics and professionals and casts a totally refreshing view about people's deep-seated desire to travel. Bringing the book together was the work of Dr. Matthew Niblett, the ITC's director and who is also a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and Chris Bure, a long-serving ITC member and notable sociologist who's advised some of the world's leading organisations. Despite the fact that I haven't had a long enough journey to finish the book, and that's one of the reasons I travel, of course, we got together to talk about it. This is a really wonderful book. So what were the reasons? How did you get to do it?
I'll tell you what my motive was, Leon. I got absolutely fed up with all the modelling saying transport was the derived demand from A to B, and that's how you value saving journeys. And I've always been a great traveller, and I know so many people who just love travelling. And so it really got up my nose a bit, this sort of endless measuring time saved and travel. So that was my motivation, really.
I think this actually stems from when I joined the ITC, which was, as you know, Leon, has been a very innovative organisation in trying to think about the really big questions affect our travel and transport lives. And one of the big questions that was raised was just, what is the utility of travel? Why do we actually kind of do it? What are those fundamental motivations? And this is actually a question which is really very difficult to answer very precisely, which is, I suppose, one of the reasons why we ended up with the book, thinking that it was better to involve really a wide range of experts from a whole series of different disciplines.
And I was interested because to that extent, it's something of an anthology, isn't it, of the view of travel from a wide viewpoint, from academics, from architects to commentators. And that was really interesting because it showed that we've all got a different view about transport. And I guess those of us who are or have been transport professionals have a particularly odd view of it, don't we?
I think that's right. And you can see that by, as we were writing the book and commissioning the authors, we said to people, well, why travel? And everybody had something to say about it, way beyond the transport world. It was a great dinner party conversation, and it ended up with, you know, all sorts of competition for people who wanted to contribute from different perspectives. So that really told me we're onto a winner here.
For me, what hit me in the face about the book right at the start was this thing that the public has got itself into, which is that travel is something that ought to be avoided or shortened or curtailed, because by definition, it must be unpleasant. But in fact, that's a completely ridiculous assertion, isn't it? Because the book very clearly to me, right at the very start, is saying sometimes people just travel because they like to, because they want to, and they enjoy it. So starting from the premise of trying to avoid it is ridiculous. And I think during the lockdown that we've all suffered, we have many of us made pointless journeys that is just walking around in a circle for mental health and for exercise. So that puts paid to it, doesn't it? Because it proves we like traveling anyway.
Absolutely. And if anything, we were very concerned when the pandemic started, having gone through all the process of getting all these fantastic contributors to write their chapters, that the book was perhaps going to fall stillborn from the press if we were launching it in a world where everyone was having their travel restricted. But actually, if anything, I think the pandemic has really made us all reassess the value of travel and how important it is, as you said, for our mental as well as our physical well-being. So if anything, actually, a silver lining has been that the theme of the book, I think, today is even more pertinent than ever.
That was really clear to me when I got it. And did you have any difficulty finding people to contribute? Did you have a much longer list of authors and had to choose, or was it hard work?
I think we were very fortunate in that most of the people that we had wanted to contribute were very, they immediately understood the value of looking at this, even from subjects which are seem a long way distant from transport. And I think, Chris, we were very pleased with the contributors who accepted, weren't we? But we tried to be selective in terms of thinking very carefully about not only who had the expertise to write about this topic, but also who was going to approach it in an engaging way. And I think hopefully most of the chapters come across in a way which is readable for specialists and general readers alike.
One of the things we had, Leon, was quite a shortlisting process, because there were chapters that we had to not include. Examples of that would be music or something specifically on art. And I think, imagine if Van Gogh hadn't gone to the south of France, or just imagine what music would be like without the cross-cultural transfers of that. And so there are a lot of chapters which we could have also included, but it would have been a long book. And maybe, there's a future volume there.
There's an interesting thought. There's already some material for a volume two. How interesting. Well, you're right about the music. And in fact, I did some work with the Evening Standard Recovery Board. And one of the things that we talked about when we were talking about the arts is how one of the things that had happened as a result of the lockdown is that since people couldn't go to the theatre, couldn't go to the cinema, couldn't go to the museums and so on, what great efforts there were to bring the museums to the people. And there were activities taking place in the streets, activities taking place in open spaces. And again, this brings us back to the wonderful way in which the human race is able to adapt itself very, very quickly to change circumstances. And we all prophesied, I think, doom and gloom as far as the arts was concerned. But people loved to travel, to go and see exhibitions, displays, whatever was taking place. And what a great idea, taking arts to the people as opposed to expecting them to come to you. So I was fascinated by that. And again, one of the things that struck me in the book is just how quickly everybody adapted to the changing circumstances and how they do this naturally and without thinking.
We shouldn't, however, fall into the trap of thinking it's all joy, because quite a lot of people have travelled, because they had to or because they were forced to, slavery, the current issue with immigration and so on. Mental well-being is not always guaranteed by travel. I was reading only this week how both Gary Lineker and Mark Hughes went to Barcelona. And Gary loved it, learned the language. And Mark Hughes came back very quickly because he felt absolutely miserable and homesick. So, there is the downside, the dark side of travel for some people.
But it occurs to me, Matthew and Chris, that it depends how people use their time when they're travelling. So I just said to you before we came on air that one of the reasons I hadn't been able to finish this book is I hadn't had a long enough journey. So I use my long train rides and my long plane rides as catching up with my reading. And the fact that I haven't had enough journeys has meant that I'm actually behind with my reading. And so it depends how you use. If you think of travel as just being something you should avoid, then it's going to be purgatory. But if on the other hand, you think of it as perhaps in your commute as an hour each way to catch up on your reading, to do some work, to listen to some music and so on, then the fact that you have to do the journey surely makes it at least bearable, if not an essential part of your life.
Absolutely, Leon. And I think one of the most interesting chapters that we found in the book was that written by Tony Hiss on travel and the mind. Tony's a very well-known writer about a range of subjects, but what he was looking at and had discovered there was that many zoologists had identified this association between traveling and thinking. And there's some explanation of that going back to early human evolution. When we were on the savannas of Africa, for example, it was a great advantage to be able to scan the horizon and have a deeper sense of awareness of one's surroundings. And therefore, with that, apparently, we ended up with a neurological capacity to process a great quantity of information about our environment. So that kind of, I think, became hardwired then into the human brain. It's why he describes, and other scientists have described, humans as infovores, because finding out more about our surroundings and our environment is very stimulating for the brain. Tony Hiss talks about this sense of deep travel, which is, I think, a sense of trying to be very aware of the way in which good travel, at least, makes us think better, makes us think deeper. I think some of that is reflected in what you were saying, that actually travel can often be very beneficial to our thought processes. It can often stimulate, I think, a sort of sense of creativity, a sense of thinking about issues in new ways, just from all this sort of sensory information that's coming through traveling, particularly in new places.
I was struck by two of those strands. One of which was just how quickly the humans moved across all the continents so quickly, mm-hmm. which is demonstrated in the book. But also a second one on the mental health, which is how people have been complaining during COVID that the lack of a commute has made them actually angry bears at home with their families, because after a stressful day in the office, you have to some extent a journey in which you switch from being your professional self to your family self. And Laura Schoaf, who Director General at Transport for West Midlands at the time and now Chief Executive of the Combined Authority, she laughed. She said, I don't work from home. I sleep in my office. That's the opposite. And her complaint was that, frankly, in the journey from her upstairs spare room to her downstairs family was far too short a journey to change from being Laura, the chief executive, to Laura, the wife and mother. And I think, Matthew, what you're saying on that is we've got examples in the book, and our history tells us that we have this complicated need, a need to travel and find things out, but also a need to travel in order to change mental state for one reason or another.
I think that raises the issue, which is very much topic today, of the environment and travel. And, you know, you will know lots of people who are not flying anymore because they're worried about the environmental impact. And the issue then raises, well, can walking and cycling be a substitute? And I think that actually there's a big difference between locality and moving away. And in the sociology chapter, for instance, we do discuss how people move from their working class areas to move social class, change their accent. And so there actually are quite wide societal reasons for moving. And it does raise the issue of, well, what is good travel? And, you know, you all hear about the Americans who do a grand tour of Europe and they say, Tuesday, we must be in Belgium. So I think the book does raise some really important issues of what is good travel and what is happening when you travel well and not well.
I want to come back to this really important point that Leon had mentioned about this sense that we need a certain amount of travel each day for our well-being. And I mean, one of the fascinating things is that, and referred to through a number of chapters in the book, was the findings, the well-known findings by Cesare Marchetti, is well-known. It undertook this anthropological study exploring human travel behaviour and settlements from ancient Greece to the present day. And he found that the mean radius, for instance, of the largest cities was the equivalent of about an hour's travel from the periphery to the core and back again by foot, which is the same as in village communities where travel is undertaken by walking, and the same in terms of average commuting times as a whole. And there's something, therefore, that comes out of that that shows that that almost constant need for travel of about an hour a day since the earliest civilizations has been retained in spite of travel methods becoming ever faster, in spite of a decreasing need to travel for essentials such as food, water and fuel. And just sort of reinforces, as you were saying, that there's something in our makeup that seems to need travel. And it's really interesting that I know a number of people I've spoken to have said that if, because they haven't been able to commute, what they've actually needed to do is go for a long walk or a long cycle ride at the end of the day, just to get that distance mentally between the working day and home life.
I'm also fascinated on this because, as you rightly say, this commuting for an hour has been with us for a very long time. And the only thing that's changed is the speed. So what used to be a walk is now possible to do from Peterborough by train. And that's caused some social changes, hasn't it? Caused people to live in places that were cheaper to buy and have more space, perhaps provide a better environment for the bringing up of children. But on the other hand, socially, has also made it the case where some people, especially elderly people, find themselves marooned in idyllic places, but sadly have no services, don't have any local shops, don't have any local bus service. And in fact, if you're not careful, it is possible, isn't it? Instead of making a move that was designed to give you the broadest possible improvement in your life, you find yourself a prisoner. And frankly, there'll be many elderly people who frankly would be better off where John Lewis delivers, where the doctor is just around the corner, where the arts and culture are just a short bus ride or taxi ride away. And so they have this wonderful view across the rolling fields, but frankly, the view of the fields is identical every day. Yeah. And I am interested in how we've had, I think in my lifetime, moves to depopulate cities and go and live in the countryside, taking advantage of the faster journey times that were possible to your place of work. A repopulation of cities, as we've seen certainly in London and elsewhere, with the development of a considerable number of new residences, in some cases popping up previously used industrial land. And now there's the COVID effect, which again appears to have people moving back out because they're now able to do their job from almost anywhere, including overseas. So what's your view, Matthew and Chris, over the social effects of this? Is this just something that will continue as a cycle and cities will populate and depopulate by extraordinary circumstances that we can't predict?
Well, one of the chapters in the book, Leon, by Deborah Saunt, is called Placemaking and Travel, The City is Where People Choose to Go. And that whole chapter is about how we design our environment to encourage social interaction whilst maintaining good ecological practice. And I think very much the view is that perhaps social isolation is not necessarily something which people have traditionally equated with living in the city. It could be the reverse if we design our cities properly. And, you know, I often do research with elderly people who are isolated in rural areas. But I'm sitting there thinking, you silly old pair, why did you move here? You know, you've set your life up in a very difficult manner. So I think that we have raised issues like that. And one last thing I would say about this is that some of the evidence in the book is quite alarming in the way that children are now kept indoors far more than previous generations on their iPads, partly because of concern about personal security and so on. And some of the evidence in the book suggests that this has a very detrimental effect on children's spatial abilities, mathematical abilities, because they don't go out and explore space and navigation. So, you know, it's not just about, wouldn't it be nice if we could travel more? It's so fundamental to our humanity and our development, I think. I don't know what you think, Matthew.
I think it's, as you said, the Deborah Saunt's chapter on travel and placemaking is very well worth reading in this respect. One aspect that interests me in relation to the phenomenon that you described, Leon, was the way in which there have been the demographic differences between rural living and urban living, which have really become quite extreme over the past 20 or 30 years, where most of the growth in cities has come from young people moving towards and living in the city, whereas rural areas have increasingly aged and have a much older demographic now than was the case even 30 or 40 years ago. And in England, at least, part of the problem there is that many rural areas have become extremely expensive. And so young people have been priced out of those places. And one of the things that Deborah is often very keen to say is that settlements, whether they're rural or urban, really need a mix of ages. Young people who can help and support older people, and likewise, older people who can pass on their knowledge and insights to younger people. And I hope perhaps one of the effects of the pandemic might be that we're seeing younger people being able perhaps to move to some of these less well-connected places as a result of being able to work remotely. I saw, for instance, recently there was an article, which you may have seen too, Chris, about Scarborough, one of those seaside towns which had seen a lot of economic decline in recent decades, that actually finally they were seeing perhaps more professional younger people being able to move and base themselves in Scarborough in a way which perhaps can help to kind of rebalance some of the economic decline that had been seen there in recent
I don't think we should leave people with the impression that the book is all a good news story. There is a dark side to travel. You know, we touch on one chapter about sex tourism and in another on the undermining of local culture. And we've already spoken of slavery, immigration. The Holocaust, even, you could say, was enabled by lack of travel. So it's a controversial topic, particularly in terms of environmental impact. And I do hope people will use the book to have debates about things like that, because it is so fundamental to our humanity.
Lunch with Leon is brought to you by ITT Hub. Check out all the latest industry news at itthub.net. And don't forget to put in your diary our next great live industry show at Farnborough International on the 11th and 12th of May 2022.
So just, Chris, just picking up on your point about the dark side, there is also the use of transport for social engineering purposes, isn't there? There is where you build roads, there is where you plant railway lines, to some extent, where you have airports and so on. So did you find, as part of putting the book together, any evidence of transport really being used for sort of social purposes like that by government?
It's hard to say whether it's deliberate by government, but economics works in such a way that people have these unwritten rules, don't they, about where the good schools are reflected in house prices. We have examples in the book of how people moved away from somewhere where their local accent was seen as a detriment to their career. I think it was Kate Adie who wrote how she stood at a bus stop in Newcastle and somebody decided she was going to lose her Geordie accent. Now, fortunately, that's not so noticeable anymore, but there is certainly a very real element of people wanting to live with others like them. And, you know, some of the new towns tried to mix people up and very soon they sorted themselves out again. So the sociological input of travel can be quite important. And I think actually governments don't have to make it happen. It just generally happens because people often feel more comfortable within their own communities.
So I'm wondering from a conversation also about what this means for the future. Does it feel like, as you said earlier, about kids spending more time on their iPads and not traveling as much as they did? Does that suddenly then burst out in teenage years for people wanting to travel the world as a result of that frustration? How does that seem to work?
We have met a lot of young people who have traveled because of social media. They've gone online and got into chatting with people and gone to visit them. I suppose it's a modern equivalent of pen friends. So in many ways, the new technology is encouraging more travel. And this has come out, I think, through being locked down, and as I've been to loads of conferences online with people from all over the world, whereas before it would have been limited by who was able to travel, usually to London, for a conference. And, you know, some of those people I've now made arrangements to go and visit in places I would never have dreamt of going to. So I think that technology is not necessarily the enemy, but we do have to, if you like, use it in a good way, the same as we need to travel in a good way and not just rush around unthinkingly, you know?
I think, I mean, really the fundamental challenge which lies ahead is how can we travel more sustainably? Because I think we're going to find, from a policy perspective, increasing pressure on policymakers to try and restrict travel in ways that are very high in terms of carbon emissions. That could well be happening quite quickly. What I'd hope, I think, though, with the book is that we move away from simply thinking about, or policymakers move away from simply thinking about restricting travel, rather to how we can travel in better ways. That might mean greater emphasis upon slower travel. It might mean a greater emphasis upon local travel. Certainly would mean thinking about traveling, making our travel choices in low carbon ways in the future. But I think often, actually, for the reasons that are set out in the first part of the book, slower travel can sometimes be better travel in terms of stimulating our thinking, providing more space for us to really experience that stimulation that good travel can give. And of course, if it's accompanied by doing travel in the form of sort of cycling or walking, then that brings other health benefits as well.
I think there's a social equity issue here too. You know, I can remember talking to people about not getting a car, and a lot of people in deprived areas saying, oh, it's all very well for you to say that. You've had a car for years and we're still saving up for one. And so there is this issue of, you know, pulling up the drawbridge and the whole issue of, can you afford to travel? And this is shown very much by, I was involved with the Heathrow expansion and the view that air travel should be more expensive. And yet we met a lot of people who said, well, this is the highlight of my life, having a cheap package holiday. So I think there are some equity issues here as well.
At the same time, I mean, the advantage of walking and cycling is that they are the ultimate low-cost kind of activities. And I mean, one might well hope that the acceleration and the digitization of the world that we've seen as a result of the pandemic might well mean that people have to be less car dependent than they have been in the past, perhaps then helping to reduce some of those inequities.
I can't help feeling that in the run-up to the pandemic, because of the environmental pressures and also the increasing influence of young people, that we had got some of the people, you know, the sort of people I mean, the people who say, I'm all in favour of all this environmental stuff, but I have to have this big estate car because once a year I have to go to the south of France, and have people justify their non-environmental existence by the worst case that they have to deal with. Yeah. And it feels to me like we'd got some of those people just over the hill. But come the pandemic, they've now got an excuse, which is their personal security, safety and health, to go back in their cars, and that their cars have become another room in their house, which conveniently just moves across to wherever they want to be. So I was going to ask you both, it seems to me that some of the problems that we're suffering will improve because of the progress of the generations. They are more environmentally sound than we are. Increasingly, there will be more of them. They'll be in stronger, more influential positions. So can we rely on the young people to deliver this for us?
I think to a reasonable extent we can. It's clear that younger generations really appreciate the urgency of the need to take these environmental concerns very, very seriously. And through some of the work you might be aware of that the ITC has already conducted before the pandemic, looking at travel trends, we know that young people's use and experience of travel is very different from the case even 20 or 30 years ago. For instance, young people are much less likely to be car owners than was the case 20 or 30 years ago. They're much more likely to use public transport. And if they do use the car, they're much more familiar with things like car clubs and class sharing. And what that then means is that those, Chris is the sociologist here, so we'll be able to explain this better than I can. But my understanding is that humans are creatures of habit, and the habits that we learn as young people are quite sticky throughout our lives. So that suggests that many of these trends are probably here to stay.
I remember a young man I spoke to who said to me, he was about 18 years old, said, you know, when I was 17, they gave me driving lessons for a present, but I managed to swap it for a guitar. So I think that young people do have different habits and aspirations, but we should remember that they are great users of technology too, and are forming links all over the world globally, the equivalent of how we used to have pen friends, perhaps. But that in itself encourages travel. They come and visit each other. They want to visit each other where they live. They get to know. I've just interviewed a young woman who's only 20, and she now speaks fluent Japanese, French, English, as a result of traveling. And so I think the book is certainly saying that there's something absolutely important for humanity about the ability to travel, and perhaps it's not a substitute for walking and cycling. And we do need to see new cultures, new climates, new ways of doing things.
In fact, I was interested, Matthew and Chris, I came across a website some time ago. What this attempted to do was to show you beautiful photographs of different places in the world. And the idea of it was not so that you could see these beautiful places, but so you could travel there and take the same photograph for yourself. And I fundamentally believe that, in fact, the availability of photography digitally, of course, on your phone has transformed the way in which people are communicating with each other, because they're not just talking to each other. They are frequently sending photographs. And what are they sending photographs of? Well, apart from their breakfast, of course, but they're sending photographs of places that they have been to and people that they've seen. I think the widespread availability of digital photography and the ability to transmit it, in fact, far from causing people not to travel because they can look at a picture of the Acropolis on the internet, it just makes you want to go and see that for yourself and take probably not quite such a good photograph, but you did it with your own hand. And I think that has a dramatic effect, I think, on people's propensity to travel.
I think you're absolutely right, Leon. And Professor Glenn Lyons, in his chapter on technology in the book, raises some of these issues. And you remember that there was a lot of talk 20 or 30 years ago at how digitalization was going to make travel redundant, and it's not been the case at all. And it'll be very interesting to see what the ultimate impacts of the pandemic are going to be. I suspect that we may see less international business travel, but that may well be supplanted by an increase in leisure travel for the reasons that you've described.
Leon, I think you've talked yourself into writing a new chapter for our volume 2 on photography. Think of all the fascinating anthropological photographs we've got in museums and heritage. And, you know, what role did that play in the grand tour and encouraging travel, encouraging the empire, really?
Here's one of these unprovable statistics. Somebody said to me at the Olympic Games in London in 2012, as the stadium was in the evening, was full of 60,000 flashing lights as people were taking very long distance photographs with a very small flash in the hope that they might get something out of it. But the suggestion was that more photographs had been taken in the world between January and August 2012 than in the whole of the rest of time. And that's not a bad attempt, actually, because photography was only developed relatively recently. It was, for most of the time, an expensive process, both in terms of taking the photograph and processing it. And it's only with the advent of digitalization and it becoming freely available on people's phones that it's taken off in the way that it has. Having contributed and edited and brought together this wonderful book, I was just wondering what would happen if we got politicians or policymakers locked in a room, maybe only for 15 minutes. And I know it's terrible with such a wealth of information to ask you to prioritize, but that's what we do these days. What threads from the book would you concentrate on with head policymakers, leading politicians, when you only had 15 minutes? What would you say to them?
Gosh, that's a terrific question, Leon. I think to begin, one of the key things I would emphasize coming out of the book is that policymakers should really place a great deal of emphasis, perhaps much more emphasis on the experience of travel and improving the experience of travel. That means, I think, considering much more carefully how travel is designed, how we use it, how we can improve the comfort and amenities provided, that it's not just about speed, it's also about making the time while we're traveling valuable.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on that and develop it, really, because travel is a big form of social interaction. Some of the bus companies, some of the better ones, are experimenting, for instance, with having a loneliness table on their buses where you sit if you want to chat to someone. And travel is a lot about social interaction. One touch of humanity and the whole world's kin, as Shakespeare says. So just imagine if we didn't travel, We wouldn't have the connections we have with other people. We wouldn't have the mixed gene pool, but we can design our transport system so we actually encourage good social behaviour, social interaction, and the sense of cohesion that we are one society and not individuals. So I think that the transport system is about a lot more than moving around. That's the main message for me of the book. It's not about getting from A to B. It's about the experience of travel. Beautiful scenery. You remember those I Spy books when you went on a train ride and you spotted things you passed? It's about that total life experience. And without it, we might as well, you know, say it's just food and drink. And we do have Maslow's hierarchy of needs in the book. And we argue that transport is right at the top of that hierarchy. So that would be what I'd say to the politicians.
Chris and Matthew, the book is very much a joint effort, isn't it? I hope all of the contributors will be listening to this podcast. Have you got a message for them all?
Well, thank you, first and foremost. And we've been very fortunate to have such a fantastic range of contributors to the book. We've also been very lucky with Bristol University Press, with Emily Watt and Catherine King and Ruth Dry, who've been fantastically helpful. And really, it's been a huge pleasure make this book possible, and of course to work with Chris.
I was just going to say that, you know, I will second that, and we had to nag some people because it went on and on. Some people wrote their chapters immediately, others took 2 years, so thank you for the toleration, and we did finally make it in the end.
So my guests today have been Matthew Niblett and Chris Bure. They have been the editors and contributors to a book called Why Travel, published by the Bristol University Press and brought to you thanks to the challenge from the Independent Transport Commission. Please go to the website www.whytravel.org to find out more about the book. It's available widely. It's available as a hardback, as a paperback. It's available on Kindle from all your usual suppliers, or of course from the publishers and from the ITC. Go to the website, please, and check. Chris and Matthew, it's been fabulous having you on the show. Our time has gone past so quickly. Lunch with Leon is brought to you by ITT Hub. Please go across to our website, itthub.net, for all the latest transport news, as well as news of this and other podcasts in the series. In the meantime, my grateful thanks to Chris and Matthew for a really fabulous chat. I'm going to invite you back to talk some more because there's many more pages in the book to discuss and lots more issues to talk about here. In the meantime, Chris and Matthew, thank you very much indeed.